had this young man come up to me who was in his 20s, and his mom had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he started crying right there in the middle of the ballroom.
If there's one issue that pegs the needle in both healthcare and public policy, it's Alzheimer's. Ellie Kaplan is bringing the hip world of digital health to the serious challenge of how we age.
This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm David Shaywitz.
And I'm Lisa Soonan.
Lisa, let's start off today with this. I know we're both big sports fans, and you've been struck, I can tell from Twitter and from everything else, by this recent NFL announcement about this big settlement for concussions. What's the big deal with that? Why did it catch your attention?
Oh, it caught my attention, well, in part because I've been doing a project on this with Dignity Health, helping them develop concussion education programs for youth athletes, and how so much I've learned about how much denial goes on, you know, not just from the sports, you know, the coaches and the like, but from the children trying to avoid getting taken out of play and all that. And you look at the damage that's been done to players in the NFL. And by the way, the second most common sports head injury is women's soccer.
Huh.
And I think about, like, my daughter. You have three daughters, you know.
Yeah.
Would you stop your child from playing a sport?
I don't know. It'd be interesting to see if I could actually be more protective than I already am.
I know. And, you know, $1 billion that they're talking about paying out to these athletes who have already been injured, not even anticipating the future injuries to come. You know, at a certain point, you have to wonder what's going to win, you know, the movement to stop football or the fans who would never give it up.
And it may have a different answer if you're in, you know, the Bay Area and if you're in Texas, is my guess.
Yeah, the Friday Night Light phenomenon. It's a really interesting, I think it's so interesting that, and that is a real, like, public policy, public health, you know, entertainment.
Well, because there is a little bit of this question, right, about, oh, have we just gotten soft and have we just sort of defined everything as being injurious and, like, life is dangerous and kind of get over it?
Yeah, I mean, there is that, but then again, these people have objectively got massive brain damage.
Yeah.
And it's not like they're boxers where they know they're going to get punched in the face all day long. And yeah, I guess there's a certain assumption of risk there. I mean, these are people who, since their childhood, have been getting hit in the head over and over again without really understanding the long-term damage. And I think it's a perfect segue, I think, actually, into our show today, although in a very different kind of a way. I mean, this very much has turned into the year of the brain when you look at just science and media, and our guest
it's
today.
It's the decade of the brain.
The decade of the brain? Let's hope the brain lasts 10 years. And our guest today is Ellie Kaplan, who's the CEO of NeuroTrack, a company focused on the brain, although a different area, finding an early diagnostic test for Alzheimer's that helps advance the cure and gives people knowledge of the condition before the symptoms become evident. And Ellie's got a big public policy background, although not in healthcare, interestingly enough. And I saw, Ellie, that you said recently that Alzheimer's is the first disease in modern history that has the potential to bankrupt nations. So that, I guess, in a way, is the perfect coming together of your set of experiences, public policy-wise and healthcare-wise. Can the U.S. think about healthcare that way in economic terms? Should it? How are we doing with that?
I think it has to. I mean, you know, Alzheimer's represents $250 billion worth of cost or economic burden to the country just this year. I think if we don't, you know, we're going to have not only a healthcare crisis on our hands in terms of actually caring for our citizens, but in terms of being able to fund our society.
I'm wondering why it's been so difficult because, you know, there are a lot of times where diseases seem to go unrecognized or underrecognized. And yet Alzheimer's seems to be an example where there's been a lot of federal research into this, an unbelievable amount of pharmaceutical research into this. It seems to be this incredible confluence of so many stakeholders focused on trying to make things better, but there's been maybe one drug, maybe, in the last 10 years. I mean, it's been, when they have the studies of effective drug development, it always stands out as the most difficult area to develop new medicines in, because I think our understanding of the biology is so lagging. What have we been doing wrong?
Well, one thing that you don't have right is actually the level of federal funding. So federal funding for Alzheimer's disease has been appallingly low.
Is that right?
Yes. If you look at and I have a theory about this, and I think it's right, or at least partly right. If you look at what happened with HIV/AIDS, when the first cases of HIV/AIDS were discovered, And it was seen in this population of very young, vibrant, vital men. What they did was take to the streets. And they did things like organize and shut down the FDA and shut down the NIH and shut down Wall Street, in fact, in order to force public and governmental attention on the disease. Today, that legacy has continued, and they, you know, they got funding and they got lowered prices for drugs. That legacy has continued already all the way to today, and we see funding levels for HIV/AIDS, if you look at it on a per-death basis, as compared to Alzheimer's disease, $350,000 per death. Alzheimer's disease is $1,000 per death. So there has been an amazing disparity in terms of federal dollars that have gone to research it. Now, there's still tons of money flowing in from the pharmaceutical side, and that is helpful. But, you know, as you say, there hasn't been a whole lot of progress. I think part of the reason is that we don't have a natural advocacy group. So we don't have, you look at who's impacted by Alzheimer's disease, it's people who are at the end stage of their life. They're weak, they are, you know, they're not able to go out and advocate for themselves, and their caregivers are consumed by their care. So we don't have a group of people who are naturally advocating for more attention and dollars to the disease. So I think that has played an important role in where we are. I do think it is a particularly complex disease in terms of just, you know, the way its origins and what causes it, and which has made, you know, finding a cure or a drug difficult.
Were there any experiences you have had that helped bring home just the what it means for people to have Alzheimer's and to be caring for people who do?
You know, it's amazing. I hear from people almost every day about the difficulties in caring for someone.
Is there a story or a particular example that stands out in your mind, or that particularly?
It comes in different ways. And so, you know, as a diagnostic, we often hear from people who want to take the test. I once got an email not that long ago from a woman in India who said, "I'm here caring for my dad. She's from the States. I will fly him to you. I will fly him to wherever you are if you would just give me this test." Now, thankfully, today we have a web version of the test, so she could take it at her home in India and it would be fine. But people are so desperate for help. I had a man from Chicago recently who said, "I know I'm on the verge of something. I think I know that it's Alzheimer's, but no one else around me will acknowledge it." There's still so much stigma that he said, "You know, I'm taking notes and I'd like to share my diary with you. And would you go through it and tell me what you think?" Now, I'm not an MD, certainly, but it was just this desire to like connect with someone and to create a community.
That's so interesting, though. I mean, you're taking an approach to this, which is really a digital health, a technology approach to diagnostics, as opposed to a, you know, biotech approach to diagnostics. And how is that received by the traditional healthcare world?
It's interesting. Initially, not well, because there's always been such a bias towards
the science guys,
and to, you know, having a true biomarker, you know, a blood based test or a PET scan or whatever. We call it a behavioral biomarker, which has taken some time to get, you know, for people to be receiving of. I think they're more open to it now. And when I say they, I mean, you know, people within pharma, people within kind of traditional academic research.
I mean, a lot of it depends on the sort of the rigor of the data behind it. And that goes for regular biomarkers too. I mean, you can talk to people like Anna Barker, who's at ASU, who is incredibly critical of what you're describing as these traditional biomarkers and all the limitations that they have. And I think maybe even some of the enthusiasm that you're seeing has maybe been because people recognize many of the underappreciated limitations of traditional biomarkers and have made people more open to both new approaches and to the importance of rigor in whatever the approaches are.
I think that's right. And I think particularly with something like Alzheimer's, where it represents a potential epidemic, we have to look for things that are more easily scaled and more accessible than the traditional.
Well, I was reading an article recently. It was mentioning Biogen's recent clinical trial, and, you know, and there was this whole discussion, the debate about the cause of Alzheimer's. You know, half the scientists think it's amyloid plaque, and half the scientists think it's some sort of tau protein. I mean, far be it for me to understand this, but the focus was so much on that And you seem to, you've got developed a test that sort of doesn't matter, right? It doesn't matter the sort of biological basis, but, and maybe it's something you should describe for a minute because I think it's very unusual.
Sure. We're able to sort of not be concerned with those things because our test is based on something different. So one of our scientists, one of our co-founders, Stuart Zola, was part of this very important team that made one of the first discoveries around Alzheimer's, which is that the disease begins in the hippocampus. So we have used, that's where our test is rooted. He spent 30 years, you know, developing this technology, testing it initially in monkeys and then in people. And so we can skirt around, you know, whether it's tau or whether it's amyloid, because we look for impairment in the hippocampus. And the way that we do that is by using a person's inherent preference for novelty or curiosity to track what's called recognition memory, which is a memory process that's housed in the hippocampus, one of the first to go. And we track novelty preference by displaying, by using your, you know, the webcam in your laptop, displaying a series of images on the screen for a period of just 4.5 minutes. And the web camera and our algorithms capture where you're looking and how much time you spend being curious. And we analyze all that data and we can give a prognosis.
And you can distinguish between Alzheimer's and depression? Because I would think depression would have a similar result.
We can because depression, the roots of depression aren't in the hippocampus. And so we're able to distinguish between Alzheimer's and, frankly, other types of dementia, you know, even outside of some cognitive decline or issues related to depression.
One of the interesting things is that this is your third startup, right, or something like that. And your first two were sort of involved in, almost maybe more traditional startup. Maybe you sort of can describe them, but it wasn't health issues in the way that this is. Does it, you know, it seems to me, you know, if you have a startup that's trying to deliver pizza, if the pizza's a little bit late, all right, you know, too bad. But here, with the consequences of what you are delivering and what you're involved with are so profound, does that impact how you think about it?
It does, absolutely. I mean, we think about kind of the ethics of or the weight of delivering a diagnosis like this. We have an army of scientists around us who help us think through these very complex issues. But, you know, we see it as empowering from the standpoint that, you know, information can help you, can help empower you to, and information like this, to really think through the end stage of your life and how you want to live it. And so if people can sort of change, if we can change the paradigm around Alzheimer's and cognitive decline and think about it from the standpoint of how can I use this information to, you know, to better live out my life, I think it you can flip it the other way.
So how did you get to this from where you were? Because I know your background's in the policy. I mean, I know you wanted to go to med school and didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are sounding, you know, you may not be a doctor, but you play one on at
least I play one on TV.
Play one on the podcast, yeah.
And I know, like me, you have a political science background, which I say is the best science for medicine because apparently you can actually get a job. There's two of us to prove it. But, you know, your prior startups were completely off mm-hmm. this field. How did you get here? Like, what was the journey from that? I'm going to be a doctor. Oh, never mind.
So the journey was lots of different things. And some people look at my background and they think, you couldn't hold down a job in one thing. You must be completely scattered. And other people see the path, which I obviously do, which is working in government. So I spent time at the White House, the State Department, the Treasury Department, working in finance. So I spent time at working in private equity. And then working at a large multilateral organization, the United Nations. You know, I firmly believe that everything that I have done has led me to this place. I think my experience in government and at, you know, at the UN gave me the skills to really navigate what is a, you know, healthcare, which is a very complex industry, entity, however you want to label it. I think being grounded in public policy and economics gave me the skills to really think about how do we address this this global issue in a way that can bring meaningful change.
Do you remember how the idea of NeuroTrack evolved?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so another one of our scientific co-founders, Beth Buffalo, is a very good personal friend. And we were having dinner one night with our families. We lived down the street from each other. And she said, you know, we're getting this data out of this longitudinal study that we've been running using this diagnostic test for Alzheimer's, and it's extraordinary, but we don't really know what to do with it. I mean, they're all career academics, neuroscientists, neuropsychologists, and she told me a little bit about it. And, you know, I lost two grandparents from Alzheimer's. I knew a bit about the disease. I come from a background of health from the standpoint that my father is a physician, my grandfather was a physician, just about everyone else in my family is a physician. And I have followed health for quite some time, was always very interested in getting back into it in some way.
So were your parents disappointed when you didn't become a doctor?
You know, it's funny, I thought they would be. But they weren't, you know, and it's funny because when I say that I was almost pre-med, I mean, I spent every summer of high school working in a lab. I spent every summer of middle school working, you know, as a candy striper in the hospital. My grandfather founded the hospital that he and my father worked at and yeah. recruited the first faculty and was chairman of the board. So it was a big deal. And the other thing, not to go too off, but
it's interesting.
Is that so my dad is a pediatrician, and he
my parents are both pediatricians, are they? So we
yeah, so he escaped the Vietnam War by going into the Indian Health Service. So we actually grew up on Indian reservations for most of my childhood, and so I grew up with this very sort of raw, visceral understanding of what healthcare was and what it really meant. I mean, we would have people wow. come to our house late at night and deliver a side of wood or a side of beef because my dad had, you know, had taken care of their kid. So I think just sort of the combination of just what is, you know, what I felt like is kind of core importance of healthcare and medicine combined with understanding public policy, and then seeing this technology that struck me as being so breakthrough and innovative and potentially impactful, it just kind of all came together.
But your first startup was completely
totally different. It was
off the reservation, as it
yeah,
were.
Exactly.
Lisa, you went there.
Sorry, I had to do it.
It was.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it was it was a company called Nourish. It's a water bottle company for water for babies. So we developed this novel bottle it wasn't, you know, if you're trying to get away from plastics and stuff, it wasn't so environmentally correct. But but it was very convenient and easy. And it was a water bottle with a tip at the top that was either a sippy cup or a baby bottle, and we sold them all over the place in Whole Foods, and
wow.
It was fun and interesting. It did not it hasn't survived and done as well long term. Because I think, you know, it's expensive. Each bottle was like, you know, like the price of a regular water bottle, $1.50 or so. But I think, you know, moms are just so used to carrying their water bottle, their baby bottle, and in their whatever diaper bag, and didn't need to have all this extra plastic around.
So I remember the time, you know, it sounds like the first experience was a useful experience to go through, but it was, and you know, and you had a product, and it was sort of, I guess, a limited success, maybe. What I remember the first time I heard about NeuroTrack was as this breakout success at South by Southwest. Could you tell us about that whole experience?
Lisa can tell you.
No, but
Lisa was my judge. Or one of them, you know, I...
Because it's sort of a kingmaker type of event. I mean, that's where Twitter had its big breakout experience. Different
sets. Also, Tweet a Beer.
Tweet a Beer?
It came out the year you were there.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. I missed that somehow. I think there were really smart judges on the deck who recognized that, you know, here you have a disease that has been, you know, not had many great big breakthrough success stories in a while. You had a digital application that had the potential to not only help accelerate and push development on the therapeutic side through our work with pharmaceutical companies. But then, you know, once that happened, we could get, you know, hopefully a successful drug, could be on the other side to help identify people who need to go on that drug. And that early diagnosis is really, regardless of the fact that we're not doing it and no one's talking about it, that is the future.
What was it like when you were there and you sort of heard that you, I mean, what was that experience like?
When we won?
Well, like, do you remember being there and like wondering if you were going to win? Or, you know, because it just seemed everyone, there are all these people who go down and imagine having a breakthrough experience, and one of the very, very, very few people in the world who's ever done that. So what's that been like?
It has been, I mean, for me personally, it was, you know, a wonderful, great thing. And especially as I don't represent kind of the typical startup founder CEO. I'm a mom and I'm in my early 40s, and that's not who you usually see up on the stage.
Don't tell anybody.
You're in a safe place here. Yeah.
my kids were live streaming back at home. I mean, most presenters didn't have that. But so for me personally, it was wonderful. I think for the company, it's been fantastic. I mean, it really helped to shine a light not just on us as a company, but on the disease. And I had this young man. So this is what I remember from South by Southwest. I remember the questions, and I remember being on stage pitching. But even more than that, afterwards, after we won, I had this young man come up to me who was in his 20s. And his mom had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and he started crying right there in the middle of the ballroom or whatever it was, and kind of grabbed onto me because it had just happened, and he was sort of on the verge of collapsing, and he just thanked me from the bottom of his heart, and he said, you know, whatever you can do to help my mom and to help everyone else, you know, we will be eternally grateful. And honestly, that's what I remember about South by Southwest.
Well, it's interesting because of all the companies that present there, there are very few that are focused on what I would call the longevity economy, old people, right? And most people, I think, in the investment world think that whole sector is tragically unhip, you know, yet you're making it interesting. You know, are you finding it, does that make it challenging? The sort of lack, I mean, I think it's growing the interest in that area.
Don't people talk, though, about the silver tsunami?
They do, but it hasn't translated into deals.
I think that's right. They do. It's sort of like, oh gosh, this is happening. We should do something about that.
Yeah,
but Twitter is so much more interesting. we'll focus on that later. I think that's true. I mean, certainly I got that from, you know, when I was first raising money, when I would go out and pitch. People sort of saw it as unhip. My lead investor, Founders Fund, and Peter Thiel, he's focused on longevity, and he got it instantly. And so I think, frankly, we were his first Alzheimer's investment. He's made one other since then, maybe two. I think, you know, the fact that he put the first money in, I mean, the first real money in, made a huge difference. But I do think that it still has a long way to go. I think people like yourself are, you know, are doing wonderful things for it. AARP, you know, is sort of brilliantly focused on figuring out ways to tell the world that there's lots of fun, interesting stuff happening in this segment. There are other groups that are doing the same, but it's slow.
I think it's hard because, like, what's the market? You know, old people are not a market. They're a massive population with lots of variants. And, you know, I think in this particular area, it's challenging, and I think a lot of people, particularly when you think about Alzheimer's, think, what good is a diagnostic when you don't have a treatment?
Right.
You know?
Now, we know that there actually is a lot that you can do, and you probably know this as a physician, but there's an enormous amount that we can do, and it's research that is just coming out, and we're working to kind of get our heads around it as well, but things like exercising and certain changes to your diet and vitamins.
So are the data on that? I mean, I kind of, my, you know, I'm sure dated understanding was that there always seems to be every couple of weeks or months some new, oh, this is the way to train your brain or the way to, I mean, because there are as many as there are people who are diagnosing it, then there are other companies who have brain training programs that they would like to believe will forestall memory loss. And, you know, that's not an area that's had a very robust track record. Do you, but is, from what your current reading of the literature is, do you feel like people are able to, that the data suggest you can forestall or prevent Alzheimer's disease?
Absolutely. So about 3 weeks ago, a month or so ago, I was in New York at the first ever New York Academy of Science meeting on prevention of Alzheimer's. And it was a room full of people who have been working on this for decades now. And the research is, you know, the longitudinal studies and others that that are just beginning to come out. And absolutely, yes, it was. My CTO went with me, as well as a woman who heads our business development and strategy and sort of acts as our COO. We left feeling like it was just this epic meeting. I mean, just mind-blowing in terms of what can be done to prevent the disease.
But will doctors, the average doctor in the average town who sees patients, who's not a super experienced geriatrician, will they know that? I mean, how many, is it 17 years till they figure that out, like it is with so many other best practices? You know, are they going to be excited to prescribe
exercise?
Well, not just exercise, but diagnostic when they're, you know, aren't really connected to either, you know, prescribing the treatment because it's exercise or eat more broccoli or whatever it is. Or is that just such a long way off that for you as a company, it's difficult to get there in time?
I think there's a shift happening right now. A doctor in New York, his name is Richard Isaacson at Weill Cornell, just opened the very first prevention clinic. I think that there is there's a new journal out on the prevention of Alzheimer's disease. I think we're starting to slowly see a shift towards an understanding that there are things that you can do. Now, having that happen and also be willing to give an early diagnostic test are two very different things, but I think we will get there sooner than we had originally thought.
Now, is it, I guess one of the issues is sort of all the timing of this. If I can imagine on the one hand, if your diagnostic suggests that someone is in the very early stages of Alzheimer's disease, that has a tendency to really motivate people to then, I mean, I can imagine people getting religion at that point. Is that too late, or is that still, in other words, is it cat out of the bag by then? Because it seems to me that the ideal thing for a lot of these preventive approaches is sort of to do it before it gets to a symptomatic point. And almost by definition, you're measuring, it sounds like almost a form frus, but like an earlier, some early symptoms.
Yeah, so there was a study out of Sweden called the Finger Study. They did the study itself in Finland, but the PI is based in Sweden at the Karolinska Institute. She looked at 1,200 people over a period now of about 3 years, and what they found, and these are people who came in with a diagnosis of either subjective memory complaint or MCI, mild cognitive impairment, and put them on this protocol, a very strict regimen around diet and exercise, social activity, so being social turns out is really important, some cognitive training, and then, you know, monitoring stress and sleep. And what she was able to do through this program was either to delay any further symptomology or, in certain cases, to reverse cognitive decline. So yes, I think is the answer.
Now, does this, you know, sometimes when there is some kind of treatment or behavioral apparent treatment, one of the reasons it can be so loaded is, does that in a sense put the onus back on the patients to say, oh, the reason you have Alzheimer's is that you haven't done enough to help yourself?
Is it like, type 2 diabetes? Is it going to turn into that? You know, blame the patient.
Some people call Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes. I don't know if you've heard that.
I haven't heard that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's because there is this big vascular component, and there are issues that are that can be similar. You know, I don't know. I think it's probably that's very individual and personal. I mean, could be. I'll tell you, it has changed the way I eat now.
What's the bullet version? What?
The bullet version is exercise as much as you can. I mean, you know, don't make yourself
insane.
Darn
it, we keep hearing that.
But turns out exercise really is important. It's a largely a Mediterranean diet, low sugar or no sugar, low carb or no carb. And then there are certain vitamins that are really important. So B1, B12, D vitamin both in the form, you know, and as much as you can get of your vitamins through your nutrition, the better. But if you do take supplements, great. But with D, it's really important also to go out and get some actual sunshine during the day.
Because there's a lot of controversy about vitamin D in general, about whether people are getting too much of it and all of that.
But yeah. So there are studies that have been run about vitamin D, and we heard about this at this NIOSH conference.
So clearly this is a global problem, not a U.S. problem, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, absolutely.
And that's especially in other countries of a similar nature, European countries, et cetera. But I imagine all over the world.
All over the world.
How does this connect you back, or does this connect you back to your early days in, you know, foreign policy? And, you know, how does this, you know, are you using the government angle, the public policy angle, to help advance what you're trying to do?
Absolutely. It's sort of in my blood. I don't know how not to, which is why I give speeches like talking about, yeah, there's a biomarker for that, about what, you know, what this is going to mean from a public policy perspective. It is. I mean, this is one of those rare diseases that, or maybe it's not so rare, that has this big public policy component. I mean, from the standpoint that it's going to affect everyone equally in terms of population. Because one of the fundamental things about Alzheimer's is that it's a disease of the aging. So, you know, there are those who are born with the APOE44 gene, and that gives you an inherent higher risk profile. But really, it's about just living longer. And so to that end, we're all going to be affected. And there's a role that the government needs to play that in many places, in most places, they're not. The G8, actually, the UK is... really wonderfully focused on this. And in fact, when it was their turn last year or so to host the G8, they held a special G8 on dementia, and they've formed a task force, and they're looking at governmental, intergovernmental bodies to focus on this issue. But they're unique.
I mean, the real challenge has been, you know, trying to find something useful to do about it. And it seems like the very first step is to be able to make the type of diagnosis that that you focused on with your software. And we're so appreciative of you joining us to talk about your experiences and your work today. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Great
it was
to see
really
you.
Fun. Great to see you.